You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's teacher retirements went up almost 15% during 2020, but nationwide they may have actually slowed down. We'll talk about the factors behind the data and hear why some teachers in the state are deciding to retire. Now, a bill calling for nonpartisan redistricting in 2021 was reintroduced to the state legislature yesterday. Redistricting happens every 10 years after the census when states redraw the lines that make up congressional and state legislative districts. The process is contentious this time, no exception. Governor Evers said he expects to veto the redistricting plan brought forth by the Republican-controlled legislature, even though that plan doesn't exist yet. The governor also said he expects Wisconsin's election boundaries for the coming decade to be ultimately decided in the courts. We're talking now about redistricting in Wisconsin, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on Wisconsin's redistricting process? Do you think it needs to change? Do you agree with the idea of having some kind of outside nonpartisan organization draw these maps? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Sean Johnson is WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief and co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Lot of bits and pieces of this story. Let's start in the state Supreme Court, Sean. They rejected this petition that would send lawsuits about redistricting straight to the state Supreme Court. Can you tell us about that challenge and that decision?
Yeah, this was a rules petition by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, a conservative group that kind of has its hands in, you know, many, if not most, of the high profile issues of the day in Wisconsin state government. And so the will petition would have had any redistricting cases go automatically to the state Supreme Court. So the court rejected that, but that's not to say that they couldn't end up there in the future anyway. You know, the court could take them through the usual appeals process. It could decide to take them directly as an original action, but it's not going to take them automatically and, you know, theoretically block a federal court from getting involved or something along those lines.
Why would Will want to go straight to the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, do not pass, go, do not collect $200? What was their reasoning for wanting it to go to the highest court in the state?
I'm glad you went to the Monopoly.
Of course, it
popped right in my head.
They were riding the race car, wearing the top hats. It was all there, Sean.
Exactly. So, I mean, there's a couple things. I mean, if you look at what Will says is a matter of policy, they're often defending the legislature just as a policymaking body. If you look practically and politically, Will is a group that is aligned with Republicans. The Supreme Court has a majority that is aligned with Republicans on most issues. I mean, it's a 4-3 conservative majority for an officially nonpartisan court. And so, you know, practically speaking, it would have sent redistricting to a court where Will knows the players. It also could have potentially helped Republicans be in the driver's seat when it comes to redistricting lawsuits. You know, if a case goes directly there, the legislature kind of knows what's going to happen, you know, and they could basically control things a little bit more than they could if they're unsure about, you know, how this litigation is going to proceed.
Let's talk about why it seems like everybody assumes this is all going to end up in the courts, Sean. The state legislature draws these maps. It's dominated by Republicans, so they get control over that. But the Democratic governor can veto it, right? So then what?
Yeah, so that's why it's a pretty safe assumption that courts are going to have a huge role in redistricting this time around. And I mean, if you even look at the 2011 redistricting cycle, Republicans had the Assembly, the Senate, and the governor's office. You know, this is pretty well known by now. They drew a map that helped them maintain and grow their majorities over the next decade. But even that map, which was drawn and signed by Republicans, ended up in court. There was a lawsuit in 2012 that was heard by a federal court. And then there was a lawsuit in 2015 that, you know, made it all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's a pretty safe bet that redistricting, will end up in court because of the high stakes. And then just practically speaking right now in Wisconsin, when you have a Republican legislature and a Democratic governor, I can tell you they're not going to agree on much.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief, looking at redistricting, drawing the maps by which we elect our lawmakers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sean, in Wisconsin, the governor has a line item veto power for the state budget. The governor does not have a line edit veto power, right, for these maps. The governor has to be thumbs up or thumbs down. He can't break out the eraser.
Yeah, the budget, it's an appropriations bill. So when you have an appropriations bill, the governor can get creative. When it's a map, you can bet that Republicans aren't going to attach that to an appropriations bill and give the governor that kind of power. So he'd have to give it an up or down, you know, sign it or veto it. And if they don't incorporate his ideas, which they've given no indication that they will, I mean, the Republican leaders, especially Speaker Voss, have said, this is our job. We don't really want to hear from the governor's proposals here. This is the legislature's job. So you can see how this is going to play out.
Now, the governor created this thing called the People's Maps Commission last year. What have they been doing?
They have held a number of hearings that were ended up being virtual hearings over the past year. And, you know, some of them got way into the weeds, I would say, on the redistricting math and what goes into decisions about drawing a map. So they learned a lot about the process, I guess you'd say. And the most recent thing that they've done kind of from a substantive perspective is they decided what criteria they're going to look at when they draw the people's map, you know, as the governor has dubbed it through this commission. So one of the interesting things that is in those criteria is that they are going to look at something called partisan fairness. So in addition to all the other redistricting criteria that they have to look at, like maps that are roughly equal in population, maps that adhere to the Federal Voting Rights Act, they are going to consider past election results as they look at the map, with the goal of having a legislative map that more closely mirrors Wisconsin's 50-50 statewide elections. So that is going to be one of the mathematical concepts they look at as they judge these maps. Of course, a map that was closer to 50-50 would be far beneficial, a much better deal for Democrats, I guess you'd say, than what they have right now, where even in a 50-50 statewide election or a Democratic win statewide, they really have had no luck chipping away at the Republican majority.
Now, that People's Maps Commission in no way binding on state lawmakers. So, Sean, one option here is, okay, Republicans control the legislature, governor is Democratic. They can have their people call their people, get together and work together on a map. Why not?
I just don't, you know.
I mean, it's almost a joke. I know it's not going to happen. But, you know, in theory, yeah. There's a world where that could happen.
In theory, there is a world where that could happen, yes. But I think you're more likely to see something where the People's Maps Commission produces this map, knowing practically what the realities are in the legislature and what's going to happen there. And they could still then present it to a court and say, look, we were transparent with how we drew this. These are our criteria. This is the reason we did this. Court, as you are considering which plan to adopt for Wisconsin for the next decade, we would like you to consider this. And then the legislature could present to the court and say, hey, we're the legislature. This is our constitutional duty here. We'd like you to consider our plan. I'm sure they'd be more forceful than that, but you could imagine the two sides making arguments like that. It's harder to imagine the two sides working together on a compromise.
And timeline-wise, Sean, this is all coming from census data. The census got backed up a little bit. When are we going to start seeing, maps show up in the legislature and get voted on?
So in some states, they are kind of preemptively passing maps. And, I mean, I haven't seen that yet in Wisconsin, but states will pass a map based on, you know, population estimates, so the best numbers they have available. so they can kind of lock in their court battle of choice, basically. So I don't know that that's going to happen in Wisconsin, but it is something that's happened elsewhere. If the process waits until we have census data to work with, you know, these census blocks, which are the building blocks of political maps, that'd be mid-August before they can work on that. So later than usual, because the census is later than usual because of the pandemic.
Sean, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us with the latest news on redistricting and legal disputes over the state's election maps. We'll hear more about redistricting coming up, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the issue of gerrymandering? Do you think there's a better way to draw our maps? Is this something you are worried about? Did you participate in a local referendum in one of the counties or local governments that weighed in on this issue? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about redistricting and partisan gerrymandering in Wisconsin as the state prepares to redraw its legislative districts this year. You can join in with your thoughts. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and chair of the Department of History, Political Science, and Religious Studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on today, Rob.
Let's talk about this concept of gerrymandering, first of all. It's been a big topic in Wisconsin politics lately. How does it work?
Gerrymandering actually comes from the name of a fellow from Massachusetts named Elbridge Gerry. I think I'm saying his name correctly, his first name. And this was the first instance of the sort of weird drawing, and the drawing that was done of the maps in Massachusetts had this one that looked like apparently a salamander. And most American government or American history textbooks have a picture of this. And it got the name gerrymander because it was done by Mr. Gerry. And so that has been with us since the time of our founding, because that was pretty much in the 1780s.
And both parties these days, it seems like, given the opportunity, will do it. Our neighbors in Illinois have had Democratic majorities do some gerrymandering. Here in Wisconsin and elsewhere, we've had Republicans. It's a way for a party that happens to hold power in those years divisible by 10 to try to keep their power, right?
Exactly. And what is usually attempted in designing these districts, and it's not necessarily, you know, how peculiar the shape is, but it's about, you know, how many of the opposite party can they sort of shove into one district so that that support isn't spread out? And how can the support of the party in power be spread out so that more seats can be captured? These terms are usually known as cracking and packing in terms of putting people in districts. And so what we've seen in the United States with regard to gerrymandering is the sort of incumbency rate in the United States House of Representatives in particular to be particularly high. And most of the time, the competitive races are primaries and not necessarily the general election.
And I've seen, Lily, people point toward gerrymandering, at least in part, as a cause of polarization in America. If I'm in a safe seat, I don't need to worry about appealing to people from the other party because their votes just don't matter. And as you mentioned, on the primary side of things, I need to worry more about the people in my party and catering to their needs. Is there something to that?
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, again, I teach in the 5th District here in Wisconsin, in Waukesha, and Jim Sensenbrenner was in that seat for more than, I think, 20 terms. And sometimes he didn't even draw an opponent in the general election. I mean, he often didn't draw a primary challenger either. And again, his seat's one of the most secure seats in the United States Congress, but it is kind of an acute example of that sort of situation where you just don't necessarily have to pay attention to the folks who are voting against you because the overwhelming number of people are going to vote for you.
Now, here we are in Wisconsin, as we just heard from Sean Johnson, given divided government, this is probably going to end up in the courts. Is it, and we, and our last round, as Sean mentioned, ended up in the courts too. Is it really common nationwide to see the courts get involved in drawing and editing these lines?
Oh, absolutely. And even when you have, you know, sort of a strange situation, I was living in the Twin Cities in Minnesota after the 2000 census. And at that time, you had Governor Jesse Ventura, who is from a third party, and you had Democrats and Republicans in charge of the various two houses in the legislature in Minnesota. So you actually had three maps that were presented from the three different parties that held office at the time. And of course, they went through the court system in Minnesota, and I think probably the federal courts as well. And you've also seen this with regard to voting in, particularly in some of the southern states, and the strange sort of assembly of shapes and districts to try to push African Americans all into one district. And so it's not necessarily always just partisan, although obviously there is now often connections between the partisan disposition of particular racial groups. But so you have gerrymandering that happens in a variety of different ways.
Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University about a redistricting here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Tess is with us in Lodi. Tess, hi.
Hi, I'm calling because I think it's an interesting point in Wisconsin that the legislature is so far apart from the general population in their opinion of gerrymandering, because polls that have been taken around the state and whenever there has been have shown heavy support in both Democratic and Republican areas to end gerrymandering and implement fair maps. And that is reflected also whenever there's been a referendum on a ballot. They've all passed overwhelmingly for fair maps. And yet our legislature hasn't yet necessarily gotten this message. It'll be an interesting year, of course. But for all the reasons that gerrymandering is so harmful to our democracy, I just wanted to call as a citizen and let all of the other citizens know, many of them already know how to act. But I think a lot of us feel helpless in the face of, you know, the citizenry wants action, and yet how to communicate that to the legislature. It's not hard to do. It's something that we can all talk about as a population to each other on Facebook. We can send letters to the editor and keep the media tuned in. I actually sent a letter this morning to four or five different newspapers, and hopefully they'll print that in reference to the Fair Maps rally that was held at the Capitol yesterday.
And Tess, I'm going to jump in. You gave us a lot to work with. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Lily, I don't know, once upon a time, if you'd asked me, is redistricting something people are going to get fired up about, I would say no, probably not. But Tess and many other people are examples to the contrary. Do you think there's enough interest and excitement about redistricting that that people are going to be speaking up and maybe get heard about this?
Well, again, this is also not just indigenous to Wisconsin. This is something that we've seen in ballot measures in other states as well, where there have been referenda in the entire state to advocate for or to push through proposals for a nonpartisan or bipartisan commission to do this work instead of the legislature. The difficulty for the legislature, be it Republican, Democrat, Reform Party, as I said, in Minnesota, is that they're designing the seats that they hold. So they have a vested interest in holding those seats and keeping as many as they can for themselves. And so the demand that the people want, which is, you know, perhaps a more sort of equal distribution of seats, either in the state house or in Washington, D.C., in the United States Congress, it goes against the interests of oftentimes those elected to represent us, because they want to keep having that job. And so they don't want to necessarily literally erase their seat.
test. Thanks a lot for that call. And Lily, the early results from the census suggest a stagnant or declining population in some rural counties in Wisconsin that have trended Republican lately. Rising population in Dane and surrounding counties that have been turning into this Democratic super block. As these new lines get drawn, what are you watching for as they reflect those demographic changes?
Well, again, you have to, you know, make sure that the state's districts essentially are equal in terms of population one to another. Otherwise, they are in violation of the one person, one vote kind of basis of our democracy. And so the question will be, what does the redesign do with regard to having more dense population in something like a Dane County Democratic stronghold when you have the Republicans in charge of both houses and the legislature?
In our last minute or so, Lily, are you seeing a trend toward change to some kind of nonpartisan redistricting formula in states around the country?
Yeah, I mean, there are about 13 states that use commissions to draw these. And there are about 20 states or more that have commissions that do this work. So you have not quite half the states that have taken it away from the legislature. But again, you don't necessarily have legislators who want to actually cede that power either. So you often have to have the voters vote on a referendum to put it on the ballot to then vote to take this power away from their state house legislators.
And in a state like Wisconsin, where we don't have binding referenda, it seems unlikely that'll happen, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Lily, thanks again for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and chair of the Department of History, Political Science, and Religious Studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She joined us today for a look at redistricting this year in Wisconsin. Coming up, teacher retirements in the state went up over the last year, but that wasn't the case in a handful of other states. We'll look at the numbers and why some teachers are calling it a career. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, join Jen White for a look at the new guidance for masks for fully vaccinated Americans and the reaction from states, businesses, and health organizations. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, more of Wisconsin's K-12 school teachers chose to retire last year. According to the state's Department of Employee Trust Funds, retirements among public school teachers in 2020 went up 14% compared to the previous year. While numbers for this year aren't available yet, some districts predict they'll have positions to fill when school starts up again in the fall. That hasn't been the case, though, in every state, and nationwide data hasn't shown a rise in retirements like we've seen here in Wisconsin. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a teacher, have you decided to retire after this year or considered it? Has a year of school during the COVID-19 pandemic made you think differently about the profession? If you've gotten into teaching recently, are you going to stick with it? If you run a school, what are you seeing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Madeline Fox is WPR's K-12 education reporter. Maddie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you talked with teachers around the state who made this choice to retire. One of them was Teresa Weber from Rice Lake, one of a handful of teachers in her district retiring after this year. What kind of things did she say about that decision?
For Teresa, it was a tough decision. Actually, for all the teachers I talked to, it was a tough decision. I think that for her and for others, they are obviously retirement eligible. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to take state retirement at this point. But they had thought about, or they had planned to stay longer. It's just that this year, threw a lot of curveballs at teachers. A lot of them were doing both in-person and online learning for students, which meant kind of twice the workload. There was a lot of just shifting and uncertainty, which not just teachers, but students and parents felt as well. And so after this year, they're just tired.
And they did take this decision lightly. It sounds like a pretty emotional decision. Can you talk about just some of the feelings that they shared with you?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we know about teaching is it's not one of the best paid professions. So most of the people who are in it because they really love what they do and they really care about teaching and care about students. And so the idea of leaving, especially retiring, because these teachers have been there, I think all the ones I talked to had been there almost 30 years or over 30 years. It's a really major shift in identity to stop doing this. And so as much as they're sure that this is the right decision for them at this time, it's kind of trying to figure out what life looks like, which is true for retiring people in every industry, sort of figuring out what your life looks like when you're not oriented around work. But for teachers especially, it's such a huge part of their curiosity and their social life. And so trying to figure out what life looks like afterwards is tough. And so then therefore making that decision to move on was really hard for them, especially in this year where maybe the farewells didn't look the way that they expected, right? They didn't have necessarily a full year in person with their students to sort of say goodbye.
And this is coming after, you know, we've heard reports over the years, fewer people going into teaching in Wisconsin as a first place. Concerns, I know, at least with some districts, with some specialties, having trouble hiring staff. Talking to these teachers leaving the profession, what are they thinking about the future of teachers in the state?
Well, it's really twofold because a lot of the teachers I talk to mentor younger teachers. And so they're really excited about the people, the younger people coming into the profession and their ideas and their enthusiasm and their passion for the field. But at the same time, you know, these older teachers are looking at the raw numbers, and as excited as they are about the people who are coming into the field, they know that there aren't enough of them. And so especially after this year, when I think you saw teachers have a really tough year, they're worried too that that might affect the pipeline down the road. Because as you say, Wisconsin has had teacher shortages for years, and they are particularly exacerbated for teachers of color, who we lose at kind of every stage of the teacher training pipeline. And so there's definitely, I heard concern from all the teachers that I talked to that, you know, not that they feel like the profession is in good hands, but not enough hands.
Maddie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Madeline Fox is WPR's education reporter. She talked about what she heard from retiring teachers around the state. Wisconsin teacher retirements went up 14% in 2020 compared to the previous year. You can read more at WPR.org. Now we'll take a look at the issue nationwide. Chad Alderman is policy director for the Edunomics Lab at Georgetown University. He researches school finance and teacher compensation. Chad, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, our pension numbers, our retirement numbers here in the state show a decline or an increase, I should say, in the number of teachers retiring here in the state in 2020. You've looked at other states and seen a different story. What kind of things have you found?
Yeah, so the numbers are still trickling it out for some states, but I've found about 15 states that have publicly reported it, and most of those states actually saw retirements go down. Not a lot, but a little bit. And that includes some big states like Texas and California, some Midwestern states. It also went down in Illinois and Pennsylvania. And if you count Kentucky in the Midwest, it also went down. So that's what we're seeing across the country for retirements.
And I know there'd been a concern in 2020 for a lot of professions, including teaching, that this weird year with, you know, the health risks and the teaching online and the teaching in person online at the same time might be driving people out of the profession. In general, nationwide, it seems like, at least going by these 2020 numbers, that's not how it's panning out. Do I have that right?
That's right. So the numbers I just cited are from people ending last school year, so the 2019-2020 school year. It's possible that we could see a rise of people leaving the profession or leaving teaching in this coming year. So a lot of departures happen over the summer, and so it's quite possible that we'll see those numbers rise this year. We just don't have the numbers yet to show what that's going to look like.
So on a practical level, what kind of factors are you watching for to determine if this weird year and this weird year of 2021 still is weighing on this decision, this individual decision by teachers, what kind of things are you watching for?
Yeah, so there's a couple things that I think about. One is the differences between asking people how they're feeling and some of their stress levels, which are certainly elevated right now, versus their behavior. And behavior is often driven by both sentiments and feelings, but also like raw financial numbers and whether teachers are eligible to retire. And so at the end of the day, that's what ends up driving a lot of people, is whether they had opportunities to either retire or if they could find other jobs making higher wages. And so that those are factors that economic factors that also are driving people's decisions.
And looking at a chart in Madeline's piece that we were talking about a few minutes ago, peak retirement season in Wisconsin, at least for teachers, is April, May, and June. That's when most of it happens. So how interested are you in seeing what happens in this spring season around the country when it comes to retirements?
That's right. So all sort of sectors in our economy have different cycles, but education has a particularly extreme cycle right around the summer. So a lot of people will leave in April, May, June, July into the summer, and then school districts start hiring in July and August. Those are the big hiring months. And so the question is what that's going to look like this year. I think there's lots of concern that it's going to lead to more people leaving this year, and there's going to be a lot more churn than a normal year. I have some thoughts on how large that's going to be, but I do think that it's going to be something that we're going to be talking about for the next few months.
Now, we've been talking about teacher retirements, implying that these are teachers who have been there a long time. Let's look at the other end of the spectrum here. New teachers coming in the pipeline, which we've heard at least in Wisconsin, fewer of them out there, and teachers, whether they stay in the profession more than a couple of few years at the outset. What kind of trends do you see early in the teaching profession?
Yeah, so the teaching profession sort of has a U-shaped teacher turnover pipeline, or teacher turnover issue, which means that a lot of people leave early on and then it plateaus and not many people leave in middle of their career. So if they have 10 or 15 or 20 years, they're not leaving, or they're not as likely to leave. And then there's another steep uptick when they reach normal retirement age. And we see that in state after state. Younger teachers will leave for life factors. Maybe they don't like teaching as much as they thought they would, or they seek other opportunities or want to spend more time with family or whatever is driving that. And then the spike at the back end is often timed to the state's normal retirement age. We see that as well.
We're talking to Chad Alderman, Policy Director for the Edunomics Lab at Georgetown University, looking at teacher retirements up a little here in Wisconsin last year, down a little in many states around the country. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a teacher, have you decided to retire after this year, or were you considering it? Has a year of school during the COVID-19 pandemic make you think differently about the profession? If you've gotten into teaching recently, are you going to stick with it? And if you are an administrator, what are you seeing? Are you having trouble filling any of your posts? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Chad Alderman, Policy Director at Georgetown University's Edunomics Lab, about teacher retirements. Up 14% in Wisconsin last year, the COVID year. Other states, though, showing a slight drop in 2020. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, maybe your experiences. Have you left the teaching profession in the last year or 2 years, or in the last 10 years? What kind of factors went into that decision? Are you a new teacher, just recently entered the profession? Are you going to stick with it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Chad, bringing everything together, we hear sometimes about teacher shortages here in the state, especially with sometimes our lower funded rural districts, say, especially with certain specialties like science and technology, or maybe special ed. How common a problem is this around the country?
Yeah. Things. One is about rates versus levels. And There's a difference between how much it's growing versus how many spots need to be filled. And so in Wisconsin, the numbers are that 14% increase in retirements. That's about 600 people out of a total profession, including teachers and non-teachers, of about 100,000. So on a percentage increase, it's not that much. It does mean that schools have to fill those roles. In terms of your question about shortages, I do think that is an issue. The federal government collects data from every state where the states identify what their shortages are. And Wisconsin identifies special ed, early childhood, math and science. It also says that Milwaukee has a particular shortage area, but then it doesn't say that there's a general shortage of teachers across the state. And the state doesn't say that social studies is a shortage, but it is a shortage in science and special ed. And so I think that is really important in conversation of which subjects we're talking about and which schools geographically are having the biggest challenges of staffing and finding good people to work there.
What kind of strategies have you found districts take to try to meet those particular gaps? We're having trouble getting this kind of teacher in this location.
Yeah, a lot of districts across the country don't take many strategies at all. So that, just to be frank, that they treat their teachers the same, they pay them the same, regardless of how hard it is to staff that particular position. But some of the solutions, districts have some sway over pay. And so using different incentives to either attract and retain workers, different compensation if it's a hard to staff school or if it's a subject that's persistently hard to keep people in. I think those are some strategies that are viable. And usually those have to be enough to make a difference in a teacher's life. So if it's a small amount of money, then maybe it's not enough to change behavior. But if as it starts to get a little larger, then people start reacting and responding in ways that we want them to. We want to have some of these shortages filled. And so it's good for districts to think about how to design their compensation to meet their actual challenges.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Shirley is with us in Amory. Shirley, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Shirley?
I just have a comment. I'm a retired teacher. I retired in 2011 when Governor Walker got elected and was going to start Act 10. And I have teacher friends that decided they were going to stay on for a few more years, and they lost money every year after that. I think the teacher's situation took a real hit at that time, and they've never recovered from that. And I don't see the teacher employment situation recovering in the near future either.
Shirley, thanks for that call. Shirley, referring to the law, the state law 10 years ago that limited public employees' union bargaining power, teachers affected, as Shirley says. Chad, how much does something like that, do you think, influence people's decisions to go into a teaching profession or stay in it?
Yeah, the Wisconsin has tracked data, and there was a spike in retirements right around 2011 as teachers like the caller just mentioned saw fit to retire. But things have mostly returned back to normal. So they're pretty much back on the same trend, and they're pretty consistent year over year. Obviously, COVID is throwing a curveball at that. But in most years, it looks about the same. And it's a matter of teachers who are eligible to retire or making financial decisions that they're able to retire financially.
Thanks for that call, Shirley. Go ahead.
I was going to say, in terms of long-term, I think that most young teachers, like most other young workers, are not that sensitive to their retirement benefits. They're just not top of mind. They're thinking about the compensation structure or where they can work geographically or their family or their other factors that are driving their decisions more than retirement benefits. They obviously want to know they have good benefits, but the sort of fine level details of how good or what the exact rules are, I don't think most young people are very sensitive or paying much attention to those things.
Well, retirement was part of Act 10. Have you seen, are there similar statistics? I don't even know how you'd keep something like this, not just the retirements of teachers after something like Act 10, but, again, new people coming into the profession, longevity in the profession, even short of retirement age.
Yeah, we haven't seen much of those changes. if you look at sort of the system-wide averages, the pay has mostly gone about the same as it was. Again, there was a surge in retirement right at 2011, but everything looks about the same as it did before. Now it does. So if you look at 2010 versus 2020, they look pretty similar in terms of the profession of years of experience or age, and salary has been adjusted. What has changed is that districts have responded, and there are districts that have different compensation structures for both good and bad. That has some implications for the types of districts. They're more competitive with each other now, and they're competing on the types of incentives they can offer. And there's some interesting research on what's happened to district compensation structures in the wake of Act 10.
Talking to Chad Alderman, Policy Director for the Edunomics Lab at Georgetown University, looking at teacher retirements. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. If you have been weighing that decision as a teacher, and tell us what this year of COVID teaching has been like for you. Let's go back to our callers now. Dan is calling from Michigan. Dan, hi.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call. I'm going to speak exactly to the compensation differences. I was sort of forced into a retirement in Michigan, and the Michigan Education Association really was weakened by Governor Snyder, and they just don't act like a union very much. In many ways, they collude with management to compromise union teachers. I saw a lot of corruption there, but now I retired in Michigan, I belong to the AFT in Wisconsin, and yes, salary differences are notable, but my dues are half of what I paid in Michigan, and I feel like I'm getting more representation. So next year will be my 38th year of teaching after one retirement already.
Dan, thanks for the call. Chad, do you have thoughts on how teachers' unions weigh in on all the things we're talking about here today?
Not really. I mean, as the caller mentioned, it's definitely a factor, and the unions have clout both locally as well as the state level to try to influence things. That's not my main area of expertise, though.
Thanks a lot for the call, Dan, at 800-642-1234. So as we mentioned earlier, Chad, we'll be watching for the numbers for this season now, spring of 2021. Do you have thoughts on just how this kind of wild card year with teachers teaching from home, teaching at school, but teaching to kids at home, how schools can react to that and try to make a smooth transition back into what's hopefully a normal fall 2021?
Yeah, I'm a parent too, so I'm hoping for the same thing. I will say that, so I authored a paper recently looking at Washington state data. So it's a different state, but we had data for 35 years, and I think it's representative for other states. And what it found was that teacher turnover is very sensitive to the broader economy. And so when unemployment rises and other opportunities are not really there for teachers, they tend to stay in teaching. When unemployment falls and more employers are hiring, teachers are more likely to leave. And I think we're going to see that here in 2021 as well, in all states, including Wisconsin, of if teachers have other opportunities, then they'll more likely to leave. The one thing I will say is that how big that is not as big as people might think. So in Washington, the data suggests that we might have 1 or 2 percentage points more people, higher turnover rates. And so that is significant for districts, but it's not necessarily significant from an entire state level issue. And I also want to put it in perspective of other sectors of the economy are also out there struggling for workers with a lot of job openings right now and trying to find workers. Schools are definitely a part of that, but maybe not as same extent as other types of employers are.
Chad, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Chad Alderman is Policy Director at Georgetown University's Edunomics Lab. He talked about the data we're seeing around the country on teacher retirements and what to watch out for the rest of 2021. Earlier, we talked to WPR reporter Madeline Fox about what she's hearing from teachers around the state who made the choice to retire. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, the CDC is out with new guidelines on masks, especially for fully vaccinated people. Is it time to throw away your mask? Not just yet, no. Sort out the new guidelines with Kate and her guests. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Got a couple good conversations going on right now over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Interested in hearing from you if you have a favorite family heirloom or a treasured personal possession. Love to hear your story, maybe even a photo of it if it lends itself to photo worthiness. You can tell us your story and about that prized object over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then museums have had to adapt during COVID-19, but they're getting ready to rock again. We'll dig into the history of museums from ancient times to the museums of the future. And you could share maybe your local favorite museum on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.